how student journalists at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School continue covering the tragedy 2 years later, the coronavirus connection to lobsters in the Keys, and renaming Dixie Highway. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. 2 years after the shooting at Stoneman Douglas High School, student journalists continue reporting and telling their stories.
Even if they weren't at the school, they were still affected by the shooting, and it's kind of like this ripple effect.
The lobster season, meantime, in the Keys is coming to an early end thanks to the coronavirus in China. It's just the latest challenge for the industry. And the efforts to change the name of Dixie Highway in South Florida. Your phone calls and texts coming up on the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. The program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Today, this Friday, marks 2 years since the shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland. The tragedy killed 17 people, injured 17 others, and it has changed daily life for many Floridians. School safety has taken up a lot of conversation in Tallahassee, for instance. A state commission was even created to investigate the shooting. That group has proposed policies that aim to make schools safer, including an armed guardian program that allows some school staff to carry firearms. The path to healing remains difficult for many in the Marjory Stoneman Douglas community. Some students have taken to activism against gun violence. Others are taking action by continuing to be involved on campus. The school newspaper and yearbook are documenting that reality in, well, real time and often in intimate ways. I spoke this week with two seniors at Stoneman Douglas High School. Brianna Fisher is the editor-in-chief of the Eagle Eye newspaper, and Caitlin Tibbetts holds that job title for the yearbook.
Thanks to both of you for joining us here on WLRN. Brianna, let me start with you. How are you planning coverage here on the second anniversary of the tragedy for the newspaper?
We publish 4 issues a year, and we're quarterly. So our third quarter issue is kind of centered around the anniversary and trying to figure out mixing both anniversary coverage and what's happening at the school. And especially this week, it's been difficult trying to find reporters who want to cover what's going on because a lot of people just kind of want to stay at home and not really do much. And it's hard to find that balance of sending people to go do interviews and to take pictures and to write stories, but still trying to be respectful of everyone else here healing. And at the same time, we're all healing out as well. So it's kind of been a balance of trying to figure out what to do that's best for the community.
Caitlin, how do you have those conversations for the yearbook where you have only one publication date, and it's at the end of the year, of course, but you're responsible for capturing an entire school year?
It's definitely hard because we're covering from summer all the way to mid-March, so we kind of have to spread any coverage that deals with the shooting, whether that's the anniversary or not, throughout the book. That way it's not just loaded into just a few, 5 to 10 spreads, because it's something that we're dealing with throughout the entire year, not just in February. And, as editor-in-chief, it's my responsibility to tell photographers where they're supposed to be going, but also understand that the majority of our photography staff is healing as well, and they're not wanting to always have to go out of their way to do something that might hurt them as well. So we have our photographers who are freshmen and sophomores who weren't, there that day or weren't a student at all, who are willing to help us cover anything that might hurt any of the other photographers mentally, which is a big relief that we have such a, awesome photo staff who's willing to do that and to, put a different foot forward for it. But it's definitely a little bit harder having to do this throughout the year versus just, by quarters like the newspaper is.
Caitlin, how do you have those conversations with the staff as they are dedicated to capturing this year? And Brianna will have the same question for you for the newspaper. But I imagine it's got to be an active and ongoing conversation, right?
It definitely is. And at the beginning of this year, with accepting new staff members who weren't there the year of the shooting, we had to have that conversation, which was, way beyond needed, about the differences between how hardworking people who were there that day and the differences between how hardworking people who weren't there. And it was a big elephant in the room for about 2 months, but we had to address it and say, you know, this yearbook means so, so much to us, especially because we have to keep covering the anniversary. And as much as it may suck, or as much as some people might not feel the same way about it or understand what we're going through, it is still their duty to design these spreads or go to events or to write about them, because this is what we're dealing with right now. And it's important to have this sort of open communication with everyone that we have responsibility, but at the same time, we're humans and we're still going through things. And we understand that if something becomes too much, you know, we can take a step back.
Brianna, how about for the newspaper staff and even conversations about the kind of language that that you think is appropriate for the newspaper in regards to this story to use 2 years after?
Yeah, I mean, we definitely, before anything else, want to make sure that everyone's comfortable with what they're doing and that we don't want to push anyone farther than they should be going. And we also understand that there's some people that, even if they weren't at the school, they were still affected by the shooting, and it's kind of like this ripple effect between everyone. So we really wanted to explain that we don't want to judge anyone, and we want everyone to be okay with doing it, but it's also our responsibility, and that as the newspaper, we're our main source of news for the rest of the school, and now, especially after the shooting, the rest of the community, and we have this duty to cover it, and we need to be out, and we need to be just reporting. And it's really difficult, like I said before, just to balance everything. And with the language, I mean, we have this kind of running joke where we'll read all these stories and we don't want to say, like, another on February 14th, blah, 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 and that every story kind of starts like that. And it's difficult to try to balance where we don't want it to be too redundant or not sensitive, but at the same time, that's the reason why all these changes are happening at the school, and you have to touch upon it. And it's definitely, I don't know how to say it. I'm trying things. Sorry.
Yeah, no reason at all to apologize, Brianna. It's difficult throughout the year, and particularly this time of year. Caitlin, maybe pull back a little bit. Brianna mentioned all the changes at the school, which of course emanated from this tragedy. What are your thoughts on kind of how those changes at your school have been covered by the media beyond your school, right? So this is coverage of you and your fellow students and teachers and all the changes and security and protocol and elsewhere. As you've consumed that news as a budding journalist, how does it strike you?
We've definitely found out information throughout these past 2 years that the media gets to before any of the actual students do. And it's definitely quite a surprise when we end up realizing that it was either a rumor or it was just something blown out of proportion. But there are a few changes that the media has covered that, you know, have happened, such as an entirely new set of administration, specifically our principal, with added security, with, you know, having to show our IDs now every single time we walk in those gates, and just a bunch more protocol that we're still struggling to get used to. And for the students and my yearbook to cover it, we've set it off basically in the beginning of the year because that was when it all happened. And it's weird to get such a rush of everything feeling the same when we walk on the campus, because that is our school and our second home to so many of us, despite everything that's happened there. But it also felt so incredibly different and weird to not see, you know, familiar faces for such a long time. And with the building of the new building and the new banner and different and the portables still kind of working out its kinks, it was I don't want to say a challenge to cover it, but it was definitely interesting to hear everyone else's opinions on it, because there were so many mixed thoughts about what we should or shouldn't be doing.
Caitlin, you mentioned some changes you've learned, your fellow students have learned, after the media has reported on those changes, that you didn't learn them necessarily as students of Marjory Stoneman Douglas.
Yes. For example, last year, the yearbook and the newspaper kids, including me and Brianna, were all in New York for a CSPA convention. And it was, I think, the Sun Sentinel who reported on Ty Thompson leaving the school.
The principal, now former principal of Marjorie Stoneman.
Yeah, the now former principal, and we had no idea what was going on. I remember Brianna and the other editor-in-chief at the time, Becca, was, you know, rushing to cover it in their online newspaper, and we were just in shock because we didn't even know, and it wasn't confirmed, I think, personally by all the teachers until a few weeks later when we were back at school.
Brianna, I'm wondering what kind of access as student journalists you've had to officials and to the types of stories that are really important for your student body to read about from a student perspective. Do you feel as young journalists you've gotten the access to officials and documents that you'd like to have to tell these stories?
No. I mean, it's definitely frustrating when you see something in the news and, like, we're our school's news and we're the ones that's supposed to be covering it and to read it from other sources that are not as sympathetic or, I mean, just the students' opinions in general. And we've definitely, like, we were just trying to cover a story on the new building, actually, and they were having a press conference there, and the superintendent was going, and all these people were speaking, and we weren't allowed to show up to it. So even though there were going to be the Sun Sentinel and TV stations and all these other reporters there, we weren't allowed to be there as well. So it's really frustrating to want to cover this and know that we have the responsibility to cover this, but then to have these roadblocks when we're fighting with the administration to do what our job is, and it's to cover the school news.
Brianna, tell me a little bit more about that incident. Do you know who ordered you, banned you, prohibited you and your fellow journalists from attending?
I mean, it was a talk about safety because they were having the press conference in the new building, which we were kind of shocked that they were doing because they had to order everyone hard hats and they had to go through all these precautions. So the administration kind of said, we don't want you to get hurt. We're responsible for you guys. But it was something that was after school hours. I mean, it was our choice to be there. And we even said that we would, like, stand off to the side. We wouldn't go in the building and we'd just interview people afterwards or at least hear the information. And they kind of gave us the offer, like, you can come by the next morning and get the information from us. So even though all these other places had these stories published the night of or hours after, we weren't really able to do anything. And we were kind of just, like, sitting ducks waiting for this story, which should have been ours in the first place.
Brianna, when you mentioned administration there giving that direction, is that the Marjorie Stoneman school administration or central administration?
Yeah, it was the school administration. And I mean, we've been very lucky that we haven't been censored at all. And I know that there are a lot of student newspapers and yearbooks that have been censored and haven't been able to cover what they want to. And that's not really the case. I think just there's more of a delay to make sure that the school knows what they want to put out into the media. And it's been a lot more regulated now with this year.
There's been a lot of media coverage, of course, of this tragedy over the past 2 years. I'm wondering, just at this moment of reflection on the second anniversary, how you would assess the media focus here on the second anniversary compared to, say, a year ago?
Compared to a year ago, I think the topic of politics and political agenda was at the very forefront, and I think that was mainly because of the introduction of March for Our Lives, of Everytown, of our local representatives trying to help us out politically because they were our connection to the federal government and to the president and the rest of Congress. But now, as we've come away from the politics, and everyone's less focused on, you know, pro-gun control or anti-gun control, we're left with what the students and teachers are feeling ourselves and what we're still going through besides the politics. And I think now 2 years forward from that event, the media is more focused on, and thankfully in a way, because I feel like when you put politics in front of our feelings or in front of our experiences, you're kind of forgetting why we are doing this, and it's because we're still emotionally healing and we're still struggling to feel safe in where we are. And whether that's because no matter what side of politics you're on, you know, you can agree that there is an issue and that the ones left dealing with this issue are the victims. And this includes not just, you know, unfortunately those who died, but the rest of us too, and the people who are still here and still having to go through it. But luckily, I think the media has moved past a little bit of politics to more focus on how we're dealing with it.
Brianna, what do you make of the national coverage, the national media coverage especially, of this year?
I mean, I agree with Kat and how it's a lot less centered on politics and how people are actually reaching out to students more, and it's not just kind of asking, like, what your political party is and what your political opinions are, and it's more about how you're feeling. But also with the trial starting up and everything going through the community, it's a lot more centered on the shooter, which is something, especially for our newspaper, that we kind of made a rule that we weren't going to mention him or what happened, and we were kind of just going to focus on the school and the community because that's what we thought would be best for everyone. So it's tough to see everything in the news and how we're trying to live by different ideals, and then to have other newspapers kind of go over that.
You're both seniors. You're both aiming for graduation in just a few months. What would you like to leave behind for next year's editors who come in and will still be wrestling with many of these issues, as will future staffs?
We definitely are leaving behind one more class, the class of 2021, who will be the, other than the teachers, the only ones left who truly understand what it was like to be there that year, that day, and to live in an era where it was afterwards, because, you know, there was a before and there was an after. And we're leaving behind one more group of kids who have to deal with it. And I feel for them probably the most out of all their classes because they're stuck here for another year. But I think what I would want to leave behind to them is how powerful they are and how powerful their voices are in journalism, but also in their own personal lives, because they're definitely the strongest out of us all. And, you know, to my future editor-in-chiefs of the yearbook, I want them to know that they have every single right to be honest and to be emotional and to feel whatever they need to feel in order for that book to be better than ours this year, because we want to keep improving our coverage, improving what our book means to the students and to the community. And I think the only way to do that is to be as honest and raw as possible, whether that's, you know, in the yearbook or any other journalism publication.
Brianna, how do you feel?
I completely agree. I think it's difficult to be the only group of people and not have other people to relate to or that kind of know exactly how they're feeling or what's going on. And I think it's important for them not to apologize for getting upset or for wanting to cover something or for making decisions that are in the best interest of the school and the rest of the community. And even though those around them might not understand it, it's important that they're true to their beliefs and to themselves, and that they act, just like Kat said, as honest as possible. And I think that for, I mean, editors and just staffers and for years to come, that they hope to cover what happened with as much respect and as much love even as they can, so that they're not pushing on anyone, but they're still doing what they need to, and everyone's still looking at our community and looking at our newspaper and looking at our yearbook, and that's not going to change in 1 year or 2 years or 3 years, and people are still going to need this information even if we're not there anymore. And I think it's important for them to carry this responsibility of what we started to keep covering what's happening and keeping the public informed.
It's said that newspapers are the first version of history, an important version at that, Brianna. Caitlin, meantime, yearbooks are time capsules. Last year, the yearbook title was It All Depends. What's this year's title, and what does it mean to you and your students?
This year's title is We've Got This. I think after last year, there was a lot more hesitancy and caution on how to cover the year after the shooting and to provide hesitancy and love because we didn't know how to deal with dealing with it. And, you know, it was a struggle. But this year, I think instead of trying to focus on everyone's perspectives and opinions and experiences, which was important the year after the shooting, but I think now was a better time to focus more on how we're moving forward and how much we've grown despite everything that we've gone through, and our confidence and our ability to really push past everything we've been through and show that we've genuinely got this. We've still got amazing sports teams that oftentimes go to states, and our journalism publications that constantly win awards, and our merit scholars, and the kids who are still getting into Ivy Leagues, and these nonprofit organizations or profit organizations or political goals and internships. We're all students who are struggling to move past this event and still come out successful, which we are, and the school will continue to come out successful no matter what we're going through. And I think that this year we've got this definitely proved how we've moved forward and shown how confident we are in ourselves.
Caitlin Tibbetts is the editor of the yearbook at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. Brianna Fisher, the editor of the school newspaper. Caitlin and Brianna, thank you so much for spending the time and sharing your experiences with us.
Thank you for contacting us.
Thank you.
The Stoneman Douglas High School Eagle Eye School newspaper got a special shout out last year. The staff submitted two issues for consideration for a Pulitzer Prize. Now, it didn't win, but it was the first publication named. Here's Pulitzer Awards Administrator Dana Kaneda speaking during the announcement last year.
The Eagle Eye submission stated that the student reporters and editors had to, quote, put aside our grief and recognize our role as both survivors, journalists, and loved ones of the deceased, end quote. These budding journalists remind us of the media's unwavering commitment to bearing witness, even in the most wrenching of circumstances, in service to a nation whose very existence depends on a free and dedicated press.
A remarkable recognition for the student journalists. Still to come, fishermen in the Florida Keys were already having a tough year, and then the coronavirus hit an important customer for Florida lobsters. That's coming up next on the South Florida Roundup. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Thanks again for listening this week. Health officials are continuing to monitor the spread of the coronavirus. Right now, more than 44,000 cases have been confirmed in China, the largest concentration of the virus. There are more than a dozen confirmed cases here in the United States, none in Florida. Beyond immediate health concerns, economies are beginning to feel some of the impacts of the coronavirus. Here in South Florida, lobster fishermen say they're taking a big hit. Florida lobster is considered a delicacy in China. Gary Nichols is a fisherman in the Keys, and he spoke with CBS4 about the economic loss.
We had just gotten our prices up to a decent level. You know, this is our normally between a $12 and $20 lobster this time of year, and we dropped the price down to the $6 range on a lobster. To the fishermen, and it's pretty devastating, you know.
It's a big price drop, the coronavirus and the business of lobster here on the South Florida Roundup. Are you a fisherman in the Keys? Are you affected by the lobster business in the Florida Keys, commercial fishing in the Florida Keys? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Maybe a recreational lobsterman, for instance. Jim DeFitte is with CBS4, and he has covered the lobster industry in South Florida for a good number of years. He joins us via FaceTime audio. Welcome back to the program, Jim. Nice to have you.
Good to be here.
How important is the Chinese market for lobsters from the Keys?
Oh, well, it's critical. One of the first stories I did about the lobster industry was almost a little over 10 years ago. And at the time, the price had fallen to such a dramatic degree that lobster fishermen were going out of business. I mean, the price had dropped to $3, $4 a pound, and they weren't able to do anything. And then about 10 years ago, Gary Nichols, the gentleman whose voice you heard there a second ago, came up with an idea of shipping lobster to China. And the trick was, as long as he could ship his lobster to China and still keep them alive, mm-hmm. that the Chinese would buy them at exorbitant prices. And so for most of the last 10 years, he was able to, and a number of other fishermen, were able to sell their product to a new market, to China. And as a result, you know, they were able to add new boats, mm-hmm. you know, have a better life for themselves. But the last few years has been really difficult for them. You know, and so we're sort of seeing accumulation of effect now with the coronavirus.
Yeah, one of those difficulties has been the tariffs. We'll talk about those in a moment. But what about the immediate concern of the coronavirus? You've got cities in China of several million people that have essentially been kind of locked down for a good number of weeks.
Exactly. And right now we're in the tail end of what is Chinese New Year. Chinese New Year stretches over a couple week period of time. And that's a period when the restaurants are normally full. People are out and about. They're having huge parties, celebrations, Florida lobster. They prefer the Florida lobster to the Maine lobster. The Florida lobster is usually part of the showcase of any big dinner. And so this is a time when they typically sell many of their lobsters to China. But that market dried up because, one, the airlines stopped flying to China, and two, the buyers in China stopped buying, knowing that because of the coronavirus, people weren't going to be going out and spending the type of money that they had spent in the past. And so as a result, orders started coming in and being canceled from one day to the next.
And things have slowed down so much that some fishermen are calling for an early end, effectively, to the lobster season, right?
That's true. Now, lobster season, we're at the tail end of the lobster season. Mm-hmm. The lobster season runs from about August to the end of March. A number of fishermen would keep their boats out through March and get those last little bits of lobster and sell them out to China and other places. But now they're pulling their boats in a few weeks early. This season isn't going to be a huge impact in the sense of nobody's going to go out of business because they lost a couple of weeks of the lobster business to China. The fear that they have is, will this still be in effect next August? Will the coronavirus still be preventing flights from flying to China, from the lobster buyers in China from picking up the product here in the United States? And if that's the case, if they go into a new season in August, not being able to sell to China, a lot of these fishermen aren't sure what they're going to do. And it's important to remember, we often forget how critical the commercial fishing industry is in South Florida, mm-hmm. and particularly the Florida Keys.
Yeah, so give us a sense of what the size is. I mean, tourism obviously takes up a lot of the oxygen when it comes to kind of the economic forces at play, certainly in the Keys, but that commercial fishing is very important.
I think it's number two after tourism. I mean, I don't have the right numbers off the top of my head, but I know it's a huge industry. Now, one of the tricky parts about this is there's good news and bad news when you have a situation like this. Now, one of the offshoots as a result of having to sell so many lobsters to China is that you had Florida restaurants ended up buying lobster from the Bahamas,
yeah.
to fill in the backfill, yeah. because the Florida fishermen were getting such great prices in China, it made more sense for them to sell to China than it did to locally.
Yeah.
But now you're not even seeing that. Now they're still not even selling locally.
Yeah, so that's what I was going to ask you. I mean, you've got a lot of lobster brokers, I imagine, looking for replacement markets for these Keys lobsters. If they're not going to Hong Kong and Beijing and Wuhan, where are they going? Where could they be going?
Well, that's the problem. You know, the Florida lobster market, because of the shift to China, a lot of the Florida lobster ends up coming from the Bahamas. So the Bahamas and other areas, even Nicaragua and Colombia, we've been importing lobster from those places, and they're able to send us a cheaper lobster here. So more often than not, you'd be surprised. You see fresh Florida lobster on a menu. There's a good chance it's actually not Florida lobster. It's a lobster coming in from the Bahamas, from as I said, Nicaragua, from yeah. Colombia. Mm-hmm. And so they've been undercutting our prices. So that leaves the Florida fishermen now in a weird bind where they can't meet the lower prices that the Florida restaurants want to pay, but they don't have the market in China anymore.
And so what happens to that lobster supply that's already been pulled out of the ocean? I mean, obviously, you know, they may not be harvesting as many lobsters because they don't have the end demand right now from China. But what about that supply that's already on shore?
Well, that's it. Anything that comes on shore immediately gets sold. So what they're doing now is, and what we went down to the Florida Keys recently, the lobstermen were basically just going and pulling the traps out of the water, bringing their traps in early. So Gary Nichols, for instance, has 3,000 traps in the water. He'd already, by the time we got there, had pulled 1,500 of them out of the water. He'll continue to pull the rest. And normally he wouldn't start doing that until the end of March. So you just stop doing it. Now, the good thing about this may be, because of Hurricane Irma, we saw a lot of traps being destroyed. We saw a lot of displacement. And so maybe, you know, and we're seeing a lot of smaller lobsters that are being caught in the past year. Maybe by not harvesting as many lobster this time around, the lobsters will be able to regenerate a little bit more. And everyone's hoping for a better season next year. But again, that all depends on whether China's markets are going to be open.
Yeah, the coronavirus, the public health question, but there's also the question about the economic pressures here, because prior to the coronavirus, it was all about tariffs and the trade war that the Trump administration launched against China, and the Florida Keys lobster got caught in that, didn't it, Jim?
It did. So in the back and forth with the trade war, one of the things that China did was slap a 25% tariff on Florida lobster. Now, it's interesting because I spent a lot of time talking to lobster fishermen about this. They support Donald Trump overwhelmingly. I was a little amazed by that. The fishermen tend to be, the folks in the commercial fishing industry tend to be a little bit more conservative, a little bit more Republican. Mm-hmm. But I wondered whether or not the tariffs, this trade war, was hurting them. Their argument is a simple one. They are hoping that at the end of the day, by going through a few years of this struggle, they will be able to have a level playing field to, in the long run, be able to sell their products to China without having a tariff. Because even before China slapped on new tariffs, they were already adding tariffs onto Florida lobster that was going there. So they're hoping that it'll come down and eventually everything will be resolved. Now, the new trade deal that the president recently signed with China, the phase one of it, does not cover lobster.
Right.
So they're hoping to be covered under phase two, but we'll have to wait and see. So, you know, you had, as I said, this confluence where you had lobster fishermen lost a lot of traps. A lot of traps were destroyed in Hurricane Irma. You had the tariffs weighing on the issue. Now the coronavirus. And I do want to make the point, though, every lobster fisherman I talked to expressed a great deal of regret for the folks in China. They have a lot of sympathy. None of them are looking at this in the isolated sense of this damn coronavirus is hurting me financially. They know that people are dying, and they're very sensitive to that. But they also realize this is having a real world impact on them 9,000 miles away.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you cannot the human scale and the human tragedy, and of course the public health difficulty here in China and some of these other areas they're experiencing because of the coronavirus are not to be minimized, as you mentioned, and certainly the lobstermen recognize that. What about
let me just raise this point too. And it's not just Florida lobster. I know that the Canadian lobster and Maine lobster from the Northeast have been cut back. Gooey duck, which is another delicacy in China, which is harvested in the Oregon area, that's been cut off. So basically, if you think about it, anything we were shipping to China that required cargo planes or passenger planes, you know, that's been curtailed significantly. So there are a lot of industries throughout the United States that are being affected. This is just one in our backyard.
Yeah, and obviously there's something separate around the cruise ship industry too, but we'll have to leave that for another time. Jim DeFede, along with us, reporter and host at CBS4, talking about the lobster industry in the Florida Keys and the connections to China. Jim, always great to have you on the program, and thanks for sharing your reporting with us.
Anytime, Tom. Always a pleasure.
We do want to remind you this week in our Florida Keys electronic newsletter, our e-newsletter, WLRN reporter Nancy Klinger wrote about how the coronavirus is affecting lobster fishermen in the region. You can get access to the full read and the full newsletter. You can sign up and subscribe by searching WLRN on Twitter. Stay close. Lots more to come here on the South Florida Roundup, renaming Dixie Highway in the region. That's just ahead as the program continues. We're back on the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening and supporting public radio. There are legislative efforts underway to change the name of Dixie Highway across South Florida. Historians are still debating the origins of the term. The Confederacy adopted a song with the same name as kind of an anthem during the Civil War. The Broward County Commission discussed the issue on Tuesday. It agreed it should be renamed. The county's plan now goes to 8 cities. They'll decide whether they want the name changed. Now, in Miami-Dade County, it is considering a similar proposal. Commissioners are scheduled to take a final vote on Wednesday to rename parts of Dixie Highway after Harriet Tubman. You can join the conversation here on the South Florida Roundup right now. Do you agree with changing the name of Dixie Highway? If so, what should it be named now? We have heard from a few of our listeners. Jacob from Weston wrote to us, it is an inappropriate name for a road, Jacob wrote us. Helen of Miami told us that it's time to get rid of everything that glorifies racism. She continued, it's not our culture, it's bad history, and I'm ashamed of it, Helen of Miami told us. And Tim, who grew up in the Miami area, sent us this.
I would keep it the same, personally. I understand that the knee-jerk reaction these days is to completely erase it from our history and memory, but I see this as a very teachable moment, especially for the younger generation. When a child asks what and why is a particular street named a certain way, that gives us the opportunity to explain what happened and learn from it.
South Dixie Highway, a name change, something you support? If so, what should it be renamed? Or should it be kept South Dixie Highway or Dixie Highway? Phone lines are open. You can share your thoughts and experiences. 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. The Broward County Mayor, Dale Holness, is with us on the telephone, and in studio is Sabrina Havayana. She is the Vice Mayor of Hallandale Beach and came up with a resolution to urge Broward County to change the name of Dixie Highway several weeks ago. Are you happy with the process thus far, Vice Mayor?
So, Tom, thank you so much for having me on the show. I am happy that my county commissioners have agreed with going forward. I was surprised but pleased when the Miami-Dade County Commission unanimously, all their county commissioners and mayor, decided to move forward with it, and they really sparked this conversation. I learned about it when I read a Miami Herald article that Commissioner Dennis Moss brought up this initiative after a resident in his district, his 16-year-old daughter, had asked him, why are we still honoring slavery, white supremacy, this horrible history that happened in our nation? Why are we still honoring it on our street signs? And so that's when Commissioner Moss brought it up, and I decided, you know what, if it's happening in Miami-Dade, it should happen in Broward as well. We shouldn't wait 5 years from now to do it. I've been watching the movements happen in various cities, Riviera Beach, when a group of seniors who watched the KKK burn crosses on Dixie Highway approached their mayor, and they moved forward with naming it President Barack Obama Highway. Hollywood changed Strevel's street name, so I think it's really time to move forward.
Mayor Holness, is now the time for Broward County and Dixie Highway to be renamed?
I certainly believe so. It brings back pain to many people in this country. It is certainly a stain, that racist period that followed by Jim Crow and rampant discrimination. And to this day, we suffer from remnants of that history. Because today, if you look at our society, you'll find one that still doesn't treat black people fairly. The Tampa Bay Tribune research a few years ago showed that if you're black and you go before a white judge, you're likely getting 20% longer sentence for the same crime as someone else who is white. You look at the unemployment numbers in our communities. In Broward County, we have several zip codes that are 10% and higher, even though we boast 2.6% unemployment rate.
Right.
There's still serious issues that needs to be addressed. This, yes, is a part of that conversation. But we also need to look deeper and see how we end systemic racism that still exists within our society. If you're driving without a seatbelt in Broward County, you're 1.9 times, if you're driving in Broward County, you're 1.9 times more likely to be stopped for not wearing a seatbelt than if you're white.
Where's that data come from, Mayor?
That was the research for that. I don't have exactly where it came from, but it's something that's pretty documented and it's out there.
800-743-9576 is our telephone number, talking about the efforts to rename Dixie Highway in Broward County, Miami-Dade County. 800-743-WLRN is our telephone number. Mayor Holness, with Broward County, you mentioned some of those much larger economic criminal justice challenges that the black population in South Florida face. Why dedicate some of the political energy and political capital toward renaming a highway where you acknowledge there are some deeper issues that need to be dealt with?
Well, I think it's a part of healing the wound. And bringing conversation about that issue leads to the other issues in my mind. And I am for renaming the street. And to be honest with you, I heard from one of your callers earlier that, well, let's not erase history. And for me, having it Harriet Tubman Dixie Highway is fine, because then you see the contrast and the dichotomy of our system, where we had groups that were fighting to liberate people, to free them. and those who wanted to enslave and suppress them, and it continues today. We see in Charlottesville the march. You see all over this country, there's still that remnant of people who would still like to subjugate a certain part of the population, and it is a sad thing. Coming back from Ghana in Africa last week really touched my soul and my spirit to really feel so terrible that as humans we have subjugated people and treat people as we did the enslaved people, as we've done with the Jews in the Holocaust. It is sad that humanity have not gotten to the part where we can love each other and treat each other with respect and dignity and try to ensure that we fix some of those wrongs that have occurred over the years.
Vice Mayor, let me ask you for Hollandale Beach. Mm-hmm. It is now been put back to the municipalities. The Broward County Commission has done what they've done. Now, because of the way the roads are regulated, essentially, it's up to the communities in which the Dixie Highway, the currently named Dixie Highway, runs through, including Hollandale Beach. What's the process look like now for you and your fellow commissioners?
So it's going to come back to us at some of our future city commission meetings. What I would really like to see is I don't want the decision to be up to me or my colleagues, because it's important to note that not a single one of my colleagues on the city commission is Black, and my city has only ever had 3 Black city commissioners. We shouldn't be deciding the name of this future street. I would really like to see a participatory process amongst our residents, to, like you are doing right now, to get feedback from our listeners, our citizens, our residents, on what they would really like to see. But especially the most important people are the elders in my community.
Can you remove the name without having a replacement?
I'm sorry, can you
remove the name Dixie Highway without having some replacement? You're saying you're not prepared to have a new name.
Oh, no, I'm prepared to have a new name, 100%. I'm just saying I don't want to be the person deciding. I want to have my residents have an input in this process. I don't want it to be only made on the dais amongst 5 white or white-passing city commissioners. The people I want to have involved are residents like Mr. Deacon Hubert Jackson, who's a Hollandale Black historian, mm-hmm. who was one of the people who was affected by Dixie Highway being the line of segregation. He's the person I want input on changing the name.
Mayor Holness, because of the way this road is regulated, could you wind up with a scenario where what is currently Dixie Highway has upwards of 8 different names in Broward County because of the 8 different municipalities through which it runs?
It could, and by the way, that's not unusual for streets or highways to have different names in different areas, but that could happen. Miami-Dade County led this off, Commissioner Dennis Moss and Vice Mayor Havayana. I congratulate you on bringing it to your commission to have the discussion furthered. Yes, we could have it with different names. I'm hoping that we could have a name that is more uniform throughout the area, at least throughout South Florida. There are talks on my commission for different names for different people. Some suggest W.J.R. George Allen, who filed a lawsuit to desegregate the schools here in Broward County and in Hendry County, first African-American to graduate from University of Florida Law School, mm-hmm. and a trailblazer indeed. So that conversation will continue. I think that Miami-Dade is leading on this. Maybe we ought to look to see what they do and make a continuation of it. But again, it's not up to me to make that ultimate decision. It's going to be the city commissioners,
right,
who will ultimately decide what the name is going to be within their jurisdiction.
And we've got the vice mayor of one of those cities right here with Hollandale Beach. How about taking a lead from Miami-Dade County, as Mayor Holness mentions?
I mean, they started the conversation on all of this, so we're definitely following in their footsteps. They're the trailblazers here. We're just doing the right thing, what I see as the right thing. I think Mayor Holness brought up a great suggestion. Willie George Allen is a really inspirational attorney, a Black attorney, who desegregated Broward County public schools, and he actually passed away last November, so I think that would be a wonderful way to honor his memory and what he did. That would be the antithesis of what the name Dixie stands for in white supremacy, a desegregator.
We are talking.
And on that note, I'd like for that to be what happens here, is that not just to change the name. One of my colleagues said if Stoneman Douglas wasn't already taken for something, but that doesn't tie into the conversation we're having about the pain of Dixie.
Yeah. Yeah, there are some suggestions here from some phone calls that we'd like to squeeze in, talking about the efforts to rename Dixie Highway in South Florida. Dale Holness is the Broward County Mayor. Sabrina Javayena is the Vice Mayor of Hollandale Beach. 800-743-9576. That's our phone line. 800-743-WLRN. In Kendall, Barry on line two. Go ahead, Barry. You're on the radio.
Thank you. There's no doubt that Harriet Tubman was a courageous and trailblazing individual and deserves to be honored. However, I think using this highway to correct perceived racial and other bad memories in our history is not really the right way to go. This is the Sunshine State. My suggestion is that's the Sunshine Highway. It leads you to and from the sunshine, nothing more, nothing less. And I think to politicize it or to put it in this context serves no purpose.
Barry, we got it. Thanks for that input. Vice Mayor, what do you respond? How do you hear that?
Well, to me, it's not perceived racial tensions or harm. It was actual racial tensions and harm. It was violent. It was relating to economic injustices, and it was relating to where you could live, work, and play.
In Hillsborough Beach, Javier on line four. Go ahead, Javier. You're on the radio now. Javier, are you still with us in Hillsborough? Sounds like a bad phone line there, but Javier's question was the renaming of Dixie Highway. Wouldn't it be managed by the MPO, the Metropolitan Planning Organization, which really kind of helps set transportation policies in Broward County? Vice Mayor, how about the planning organization? Does it play a role here?
So I'm familiar with the MPO, and I think they deal more with traffic calming, whether we should have more bicycle lanes, whether we need a new highway, not really so much in street renamings.
Yeah, the MPO I served on for many years.
Yeah.
This is not within their jurisdiction. They're not about street names. They're about a coordinated effort to ensure that we have an infrastructure for moving traffic and people throughout the region.
Have you studied, Mayor or Vice Mayor, the financial impact of a name change, the street signs that are going to have to be changed, and the other kind of cost, the hard dollar cost that it's going to take of any kind of naming?
Mayor Holness, you want to take this one?
Yes. I asked our staff to look at it, and they gave me an estimate. It's a broad estimate, from $100,000 to $200,000 for the portions that's under the county's jurisdiction.
So that's just
we manage it. So let's even go further with this. There's about half of the roadway in Broward County is we have an interlocal agreement with a city that the county, that's a county road. And then the other portion of it is actually considered a state road. So within the county road process is more of what we are having the discussion about, which includes Hollandale and Hollywood and Dania. But when we go north, it is actually considered a state road. For that portion, it's about $100,000 to $200,000.
I see. And for Hollandale Beach, for instance, what could be the cost for renaming?
I don't see a city cost, since these are county streets, but we would definitely help in advocating or lobbying to the city, the county commission. We would also try to lead some sponsorship efforts. I really do think this could be a fundraised effort if there is that much blowback or county commissioners don't see spending public dollars on this. But I've seen public dollars spent in a lot of other wasteful ways, so I think this would be a conductive way.
The Vice Mayor of Hallandale Beach, Sabrina Javayena, with us. Thank you so much, Vice Mayor. Appreciate it. And Mayor Dale Holness, the Mayor of Broward County. Mr. Mayor, thank you for your time today as well.
And I thank you for allowing us to have this public discourse.
Much appreciated. That's what among the many reasons why WLRN exists and thrives here in South Florida. Finally, on the roundup, we do want to let you know again that the WLRN news team is embarking on a new elections project this year here in 2020. We've partnered with The World on Public Radio International. The project is called Every 30 Seconds. Every 30 seconds, a Latino in the United States turns 18 years old, voting age. And we'd like to talk and connect with young Latinos across South Florida who will be voting for the first time. If that's you, we'd like to hear from you. Text the word hello to 786-590-2262. Text the word hello to 786-590-2262. Remember that standard messaging rates apply. That'll do it for the South Florida Roundup this week. It is produced by Alexander Gonzalez. Our engagement producer is Katie Lepre. Our news director, Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. The director of radio operations is Peter J. Mertz. The director of radio programming is Jason Zabka. The show's technical director and technical supervisor is Richard Ives. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling, listening, and supporting Public Radio. The program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist.